All right, and welcome to another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm here with my co-host, Neil Dewing. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Jay. How are you?
I'm doing great. As always, we ask everyone, if you're listening to this and you like it, please go out, subscribe to the podcast. You can find it on iTunes, and leave us a review as well. We want to hear what you think.
So we really do.
We do, especially Neil. Neil's attention needy, so he needs all the encouragement he can get, even hate mail. As long as you're talking about him, he likes it.
All attention is good attention.
Exactly. We're in the midst of a series of shows that we're doing here. We're profiling people in certain professions that we admire, but a lot of the cranks and stuff on the internet and elsewhere think are these kind of, people that do these things because they just want the money. They're just there for the money. They're not doing anything for God and country, that kind of thing.
They're easily caricatured.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So we had a show where we featured Ed Morrissey as a professional blogger. And this time around, we have a congressional staffer. Actually, my congressman, Barry Lauterbach, here in the 11th District of Georgia. We have his chief of staff on with us tonight, Mr. Rob Atkerson. Rob, how are you?
I'm well. Happy to be on with you guys.
All right. We appreciate you taking the time to do this. You guys are probably pretty busy, election year and all that good stuff. So probably a lot going on. So we appreciate it.
We're in a good phase right now, having just finished the primary in a solidly Republican district. We do have a general opponent, but it's not quite a heated race as it may be in some other parts of the country.
I don't think it's going to be too much of an issue. But I'll still be out there voting, and I'll encourage others to do as well.
We appreciate it.
Yeah, but Rob, let's start simple. Let's tell us about yourself, a little bit about your background and how you kind of came to get to D.C. Because with that accent, my friend, you're not from the Washington D.C. area, so. Kind of give us a little bit about yourself.
I'm not from D.C. I'm not don't really have a political training background. I was a small business owner, and through a course of events, came to know Barry Loudermilk when he was my state representative, and then running for state senate. And over time, we got to know each other, worked together a little bit in politics and in business, and eventually I ran his congressional campaign for the first campaign in 14, and kind of the rest is history. I didn't have a political background so much as I was involved. Alarm and surveillance business. I had a small business that we opened back in 2005. I got into politics because politics got into me with Dodd-Frank. I had an alarm and surveillance business, and when the housing market crashed, my business partner and I kind of averted disaster by sliding into a niche market, which was doing alarm and surveillance in community banks, which is a little bit tough to get into, but we had some connections and got into that, and we're on a great trajectory to make quite a bit of money and grow the company. And we had a lot going on. This was back right about the time that Dodd-Frank was passed, right before the banking crisis. And Dodd-Frank gave the FDIC an inordinate amount of power, and they came into Georgia and said, "You have too many banks. You can't build any more." Took everything off the books, and basically wiped away 2 years of future business that we already had contracted, and so shut that down and forced us to find another alternative. And that's when I started to realize how much I didn't understand about our system. I knew that it was how can the FDIC do this, and I really started to dig in and get a little more than just kind of voting and campaigning periodically. And so I really started to get involved and understand policy and look at how Washington works. And that's how I got to, I came to know Barry through local party activities and Tea Party events and these kind of things, and that kind of piqued my interest. So as we came to realize that we were in somewhat the same line of work. He was in data infrastructure and IT business, and so we did a few jobs together. We did some campaigning together. I helped him on his state campaigns, and so again, one thing led to another. And we when he asked me to run his congressional campaign, I didn't have a whole lot of experience, but what he was looking for was somebody who had run a business. He says, you know, he believes we need more people up here who understand business and who understand the philosophies and the principles of running a business. And so we ran the campaign like a business, and here we are. We've spent the last year and a half in the most drastic learning curve of my life.
So Rob, you were a normal guy. You had a business. things were going well for you. Then you're rolling with the punches with the economy, and then all of a sudden this regulation comes in and overturns the apple cart, as it were. And that's right. So that's what spurred you to get involved in a big way, in a major way. And so you, political staff professional, you did not come to it through the channels that some people do, you know, some people who work their way up from being, you know, an intern,
right?
You know, and spend their formative years on the Hill. You're not coming from that background. You're coming from what they kind of call real America, I suppose, but rather disparagingly. But you know, it's that's a different perspective.
It is, and there's a handful of folks like me up here who have come here for various reasons, or with somebody that you know, they were involved in their campaign. There are by and large, this place is run by folks who intended to be here, who were interns, who went to school in D.C. or wanted to come here for one reason or another and had those aspirations. But I think part of the culture shift that's happening up here, there are more and more both members and staffers who have come with some business experience and some outside, as you put it, real world experience, not to disparage anybody else up here. I think I will say pretty definitively that part of our problem with this, the current administration, if I could get political for a second, is that it's basically dominated by folks who don't have any real world experience. Mm-hmm. And what we deal with day in and day out is a constant barrage of regulation and this kind of stuff. And we hear from people out there in the real world, in the business community, who are suffering the results of that inexperience. So I think we need probably a little more, both elected officials and their staff, who have some understanding, real understanding of how business works, how the real world works, how to make a payroll, and how to run a budget.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that has struck me, and Rob, maybe you can speak to this, is that a lot of, and this is just from what I can say, maybe I'm wrong, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like there's a lot of staff members, congressional staff members, who are really young. We're talking about people who are like 23, 24, 25 years old, don't have a lot of that real world experience. And so it's seemingly, when they're dealing with the public, sometimes they're not on top of it the way somebody else might be. I'm trying to understand why, like, you know, for obviously Barry said, hey, I want you up here and make you my chief of staff because he's familiar with you and worked with you before and everything like that. But it seems like a lot of times some people don't do that, and they take a risk. And I don't know, maybe at that point they're not being, you know, they're not in touch with their communities. I mean, we've seen it with people getting defeated because it doesn't seem like they're in touch with their congressional districts, the people that they actually represent.
Right. You know, Eric Cantor comes to mind.
Yes.
But so Barry's approach was, and he's kind of always had this philosophy. Of course, when he was in the State House and State Senate, you don't have a paid staff there. His family, who is a very close-knit family, his family was basically his staff and his support base around him. So they've always had a very, you know, and families get a bad rap in politics because there's a few bad seeds who try to use the situation to pad the pockets of their family, those kind of things. But in their case, they're all in this thing for the right cause. You know, it's never about, it's really, it really absolutely is not about the money, and they're in this thing and they support each other. And so when he went to build a staff out for a congressional office, and the good thing for us was we had a primary, a tough 6-way primary, and then a runoff in the first election, and then no opponent in the general. So after that July runoff, we had basically 6 months to put together an office. Uh-huh. The biggest problem was you can't officially do anything until the election results are certified after November. But what we could do was start to gather information, and I found some pretty good organizations up here, nonprofit organizations, who exist to help new members set up staff and make things more efficient up here. So I started to work a lot with some of those guys, and they helped us gather information. And we were well ahead of the curve by the time new member orientation came around, because we had all that time to prepare, where these other guys who win in November after a tough election, they've got 2 months to put this thing together and learn what they're doing.
Right.
So Barry's philosophy was, we're going to find, you know, the number one thing we're looking for first and foremost is people who are in this thing for the right reason, who believe in a cause, who are passionate about what they do. We hired a few people from other, one or two from other congressional offices, and a couple of people in D.C. who had been here for a little while, because we know we're realists and we know you got to have somebody who knows their way around.
Sure.
But then we also brought with us a lot of people who were part of his support organization and friends, and friends meaning people who were there and supportive and want to be in this thing and help make a difference. So we've got a staff of people who believe in the cause and who love coming to work every day, and they're in this thing, and a lot of them, most of them, by the way, are from the district, so they do understand the people there, and they matter of fact, they know a lot of the people there, but they understand everything about the district, the demographics and the makeup of the district. So people, as a matter of fact, the girls that we hired later in the year in 2015, she's actually from Idaho, but she graduated from Hillsdale College, and she had interned with us. And so when we interviewed her, we interviewed her via Skype, and we asked her a series of questions. And Barry says, "So the final question is, if you want to come, since you're not from Georgia, can you tell me what's the number one landmark in Marietta, Georgia?" And she, of course, she had no idea. And so, and Barry said, "Well, that's a tough one. I don't know. We'll have to think about, we'll have to think about it and get back to you." About 3 days later, we got a postcard in the mail from her that had the big chicken. And so we called her up and said, "Okay, you're good to go." Well, she was already good to go, but
that sealed the deal.
We want to make sure that they know, that they understand the district. So we've had a couple of different staff retreats, and we brought the staff down there and really took them around and taught them about the district, and had a lot of basically 11th district courses for so that they would have a good understanding, the two or three people that we have that are not from the district. So that was so important.
Rob, you're the chief of staff, that's right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes. Now, so how would you describe your primary role in your job? Like, what is it that you would see as your primary duty? Or alternately, describe kind of like your workflow, your day to day, how things operate for you.
Well, and that's actually kind of there's some things that are day to day, just that they're depending on where we are. I travel back and forth when they're in session. I stay in D.C. when they're in session when the Congress is up here doing damage. I'm usually in D.C. and when he flies back. Almost all the whenever they're not in session, he flies back. His wife travels up here with him, and mm-hmm. So we're here to focus on the business at hand when we're up here, and then we go back in the district when they're not. And I would probably describe my job as just as a manager to make sure that everybody, all the folks on our team, have the tools that they need to have input when there's any question about that. Make sure things are flowing. Keep an eye on the political landscape mm-hmm. as well as the legislative landscape and every other part of it. I mean, I'm kind of, I don't know, just kind of oversee the whole operation. And, of course, I'm involved in the conversations up here when we're discussing legislation. it's hard to kind of pin it down because it changes from day to day, but it's a personnel manager, kind of a CEO, almost like a CEO of an organization. I guess you would think that, well, the congressman is a CEO, but he has a job to do as a, mm-hmm. As a congressman and as a representative. And then there's an organization of staff that I just need to make sure that everybody has the tools they need. We've got a really amazing staff. We've got great people in positions. We've got a district director back in the district who kind of oversees our field staff and our constituent services. I make sure they have the tools they need. I run, I run the budget. I run the payroll and make sure everybody's taken care of in that regard. And it's kind of like a management position,
yeah.
as well as an assistant and kind of a confidant, for lack of a better word, for the congressman.
I can hear that business influence in there, because that sounds very much like my job, like what my, not my personal job, but what my CEO, what my vice presidents do in my company that I work for. And the way, like you said, looking at the layout and the what's coming up, the lay of the land, that sort of thing. That's an important part of being in that leadership role.
Well, and I tell you that the last since qualifying, when we found out we had those opponents in the campaign, those 2 months were some of the were pretty wild. It was a pretty wild ride, because what I did was, working as the congressional chief of staff, I don't spend, during my work time, I don't work on the campaign. We had to keep that kind of time separate. So what I did, mm-hmm. what I had to do during that time was I actually reduced my congressional salary, and by the same percentage that I was going to work, spend time, paying attention to the campaign. I mean, we had somebody on the ground running the campaign, but of course you can't really separate that. And most chiefs of staff are kind of, keep an eye on that side of things, but you don't really spend any time during the day on that. So it was double duty, and it was pretty intense for a while, because we had some valid opponents. And so I was basically doing both. And the days were all over the place with kind of the both of those jobs, those of those jobs intermingled. And it was quite a learning experience. It definitely made us appreciate the day to day without the campaign on top of everything. So we're actually really excited about what's going on right now. We have a year and a half learning the ropes up here, and back, how to run a congressional, what a congressional office looks like, and Barry said all along, running for Congress, he said, people say, what are you going to do in your first 100 days, or what are you going to accomplish in your first 100 days? And he would say, well, I'm going to learn where the bathrooms are, and I'm going to build relationships and start building alliances. And it sounds, everybody says, you got to know your way around. But the thing is, politics, state house or D.C. or anywhere else, it's all about relationships and who you know. And so he was serious about that. And we've spent the time getting to know folks, letting folks get to know him, building some alliances, getting to know leadership. And so, now we've got this first re-elected under our belt, and we've had already started to lay out his agenda, and so that's what we focus on now. I'm focusing our team on his agenda, which he's introduced a few bills, passed a couple, but we've got a big kind of a bold agenda, and that's a business. I mean, that's kind of a focus in itself, is to get our team. We've got to communicate, people back in the district communicate what's going on up here and what he's working on, but then we've got a whole. It's a major project to get these two or three pieces of signature legislation that we're working on right now and get our team focused on that. And so it's a pretty neat experience, particularly from a business perspective, if you look at it that way. But project management and project organization, as a matter of fact, that's what I've been kind of focused on since the election, was some ideas for strategic planning and that kind of stuff, and incorporating that into what we're doing up here. So.
Interesting. Rob, you brought up, one of the things you mentioned, and I know Neil was probably chuckling a little bit about this, was the whole idea of building relationships. That
I was planning a follow-up question.
Yeah. Go ahead,
take it, Jay.
Yeah. So that's one of the things that we kind of, when people are on the outside looking in, they want you to go to town and just start, just bowling things over and, you know, we, you know, get rid of Obamacare. And if you don't do it, then, you know, you failed or you betrayed us because you didn't do this or you didn't do that. And I'm sure, and I know, I mean, I've seen the campaign literature from Barry's opponent. So I get it, you know, but I think what you bring up is a great thing that, hey, you know, you got to go in there and start, you know, making contacts, establishing relationships, because Neil will always say this, is that you're going to have trouble getting things done if nobody likes you.
Which it applies in politics, it applies in business,
right?
You know, it applies in life. If nobody likes or trusts you, you're going to have a real hard time.
That's exactly right. And so, you know, we can't, you know, one of the things we've talked about up here quite a bit is, you know, Barry talked about in the conservative movement, and his kind of spiel is if in the conservative movement, historically, we've defined victory by how many bodies are lying at the bottom of the hill, still clutching the "Don't Tread on Me" flag, but the other side still has the hill. We never take a hill. We celebrate martyrdom and saying, you know, and just burning things down and saying no, but we don't get any victories that way. It's not you know, what we're trying to do is is move things in the direction we want it to be, to have an influence on legislation. And you can't do that if like you said, if nobody likes you, if you're not at the table, if you don't have a seat at the table, you don't have any input. And Barry, you know, early on in his first term, there was a group up here of folks. Some of the folks had been around for a while. Some of them were new, and they formed what they call the House Freedom Caucus. And they, you know, some of them have gotten a bad rap from time to time. And they've done, by and large, there's been some times when Barry and some others didn't necessarily agree with the whole group. But the idea of it was to have a group of people who were working to get to yes, who wanted to use their influence as a block to try to move legislation to the right and to have an influence and a seat at the table. And what he's managed to do, not really just through House Freedom Caucus, but we have a great relationship with Speaker Ryan. We're very excited about his leadership and the things that the agenda that he's laying out. We're right there in the middle of that. Majority Leader McCarthy, we've got great relationships with those guys. What folks have come to learn up here over a year and a half is that Barry Loudermilk, and I knew this from the state Senate, a lot of people in the state House, people in Georgia knew this about him, even though he had this reputation as the one of the foremost conservatives in the state of Georgia, he had a great working relationship with people, you know, with people across the spectrum down there, you know, that would, you know, he still has a great mutually respectful relationship with folks like Nan Orrock and you know, people in the Georgia General Assembly who ideologically are nowhere near Barry Loudermilk. And so you can have that. You can have a mutually respectful relationship and that makes things workable. One of the things we saw up here, one of the problems we saw with D.C. when we got up here is we came up here for new member orientation, and basically they said, okay, There were 57 new members, 10 were Democrats and 47 Republicans, and they said, well, welcome to Washington, and they did one little quick session together, all 57, and then they said, okay, the D's are going to go over here and do their orientation, and the R's over here. And it was around February when we realized we really hadn't seen any of those folks. And Barry was used to doing all his work on the floor in the General Assembly, where everybody's together, and that's where most of the work goes on, and you get to know each other, and you chat, and you talk, and you get to know people personally. And this place is geared against that ability, because everything is done in committees, nothing's done on the floor, and if you don't make an effort to get to know people, you won't. And so they're actually, it's designed to be polarized. So we started to reach out to some of those folks and around in our building, starting with our building, and saying, hey, let's schedule 30 minutes to sit down and talk about no policy. Policy is off limits. Let's talk about how you got here, and you know, what's your wife's name? How many kids do you have? What do you like to do on the weekends? And humanize each other and get to know each other. And it's not just Democrats and Republicans. There's the Republican conference up here is very diverse. You know, we've got Republicans from you know, basically Democrat districts in New York and the Northeast and all over the country. And so we've got a very diverse Republican conference. And so you have to make an effort to build relationships and get to know people. And although you may not, you know, a lot of times you're going to be on different sides of an issue, we have to find places where we can agree. And there are some core issues that where we can all agree. You know, Mary's to we talk to a lot of people and say, you know, do you think it's a good idea that we have a $20 trillion debt? Mm-hmm. Virtually all 535 members up here will agree with you. It's not a good idea to have $20 trillion debt. So there's some areas of agreement, and that's where he's tried to focus and build relationships and, you know, across the spectrum and try to have an influence. And it's working.
But there are some obstacles to that. It sounds like that just kind of the culture there isn't necessarily as collaborative as it is in the state house in Georgia there.
Well, that's the political hurdles. And then we have some cultural hurdles in our country right now. You know, and sure. you guys are aware, you're talking about this stuff. We've got a polarized is probably not the right word, because there's so many different poles, so many different factions and so many different areas of where people kind of congregate and disagree with each other and scream at each other. And I think that's kind of what you guys were going at with this program, is what we deal with is the folks that we've got some shortcomings. Personally, one of my observations is that there's some shortcomings in our civics curriculum. People don't really understand what's happening right now. We think in the culture is that people don't, people know that we've got some problems, and people start to feel a sense of panic. My personal belief is that we're kind of lying to ourselves about the economy, and people are all feeling the pinch. And, you know, I've kind of observed this over the last year and a half. The people say that the number one cause of marital stress is financial problems. When couples get into financial dire straits, they tend to fight, and that drives the divorce rate up. I personally think what we're dealing with right now is that we've got this a recession or a recovery that's not really a recovery, and there's inflation, and folks are not getting the same amount of money when they go, the same amount of food when they spend more money at the grocery store, and we've got this kind of invisible pinch. And everybody's kind of stressed out, and they're wanting to scream at each other, and so the easiest thing to do is to blame Washington for not fixing everything mm-hmm. overnight. And
it is very easy.
Well, and there's a reason to blame Washington for the things that have happened over time. We've got some pretty big problems to fix. These are not things that you fix overnight, and we didn't get here in overnight. So. Anyway.
Would you say that cultural divide extends into Washington, and that among, say, the professional staff on the Hill there? I know that a lot of people will work for a politician they don't necessarily ideologically agree with. A lot of the professionals on the Hill, not, you know, folks such as yourself who came to it from a business background and who, you know, are motivated because of, you know, your beliefs and what's bringing you in there. But some of the, you know, more career oriented staffers, do you get a sense that divide is there on the Hill, you know, based on ideology? Do liberals and conservatives socialize in your experience? Is there kind of a camaraderie there, or is that still a split there?
There is. There's a professional respect up here that you can sense. I think a lot of the folks on the staff, you know, people that are, like you said, who are in this for a profession, they usually tend to try to find somebody that they relate to. There's a lot of folks who have worked on both sides of the aisles. I've met a lot of folks. There's a great organization up here, and this is one of the ones that I work with, called the Congressional Management Foundation, and it's made up of former chiefs of staff, and they saw a need, and they formed this organization, and they work with Congress to do new member orientation. They do a lot of trainings for staff and mostly for staff and chiefs of staff about different ways to make the office more efficient and overcome some of the common problems that offices have. And these guys, some of the ones that that founded this organization, they've got stories of, you know, having worked for both sides of the aisle and understanding the issues. And because, you know, when you're talking about the management of an office, a lot of the jobs in the office really don't have anything to do with the policy and the politics of the situation. The folks who work in the legislative arena up here are usually a little more prone to try to find somebody that fits their ideology. You don't see a whole lot of crossover. Folks who, if it's a more moderate Republican member, you may find a little more staffers in there who have maybe a little more Democratic leanings or liberal leanings. But by and large, every other part, a lot of the other parts of the office, particularly in the district, staff, those folks, you know, there's not a lot of politics per se. As a matter of fact, in our constituent services area, you know, when the congressman started putting the staff together, when we had the staff together, we started talking about our philosophy and the way we're going to do things. He told everybody, he said, "Look, here's the thing. We're elected to represent 750,000 people. Your representative, you know, part of the issue out there in the district is in all districts, for that matter, is that." Because we're so partisan, you know, in the media and as a society, when you have a Republican congressman, you've got whatever percentage is not Republican in the district. They think, well, they don't have a representative. And he said, look, our job is to represent those people and to be a kind of a mediator between them and this big overgrown federal government. And the federal government does. There's a lot of programs that people deal with day to day that we may not agree with, and we may eventually work to get rid of some of those programs, but for right now, they're programs, and they exist, and they're law. They're the law of the land, and so people deal with them. Our job is to try to be, you know, to try to alleviate the burden that this government puts on people. So we have we pay a lot of attention to our constituent services. Mm-hmm. You know, we help veterans, we help folks with Social Security, we help immigration cases. With some of our, you know, some of our more conservative base, they don't really care to deal with that kind of stuff. But it exists in the district, and we deal with, you know, we help a lot of people and some very interesting cases. And so there's a lot of parts of a congressional office that aren't partisan, and so those people, I think, there's definitely a lot of camaraderie, and it's a culture. It's a little, you know, while everybody who works in the congressional in Congress, either in the Senate or the House, we're considered, considered federal employees, but there is a distinction between House and Senate staffers and federal agency employees. There's definitely a distinction there where you don't. Where it's kind of a different culture, because there's a lot of turnover in the congressional world and a lot of movement. And when I was studying and building up the office in that year after we won the runoff, one of the things I read that stuck out to me was that Congress, on a staff level, is the last great meritocracy is the term they used, and that is. If you work hard and you're good and you're great, I mean, you can move up. That's why there's some of these young kids that are up here, and there's some kids half my age that are chiefs of staff, and you know, because and a lot of times that's because it could be a budgetary issue, or it could be because they're good at what they do, and because the congressman has come to know them and they trust them, or sometimes some of the congressmen. They don't cede as much of the day-to-day decision making over to the chief of staff, so they want somebody who just kind of to manage their decisions and to enact what they want to do. So
it always weirds me out when I see like a 25-year-old who's got a director title or something like that, you know, director of communications.
Exactly.
I see a lot of it, and some deserving and some make you wonder. So.
Well, let me ask you this, Rob. What two questions here? What was something that surprised you the most when you got to D.C. and what's something that surprised you the least? Can you think of anything like that? What's something that really kind of whoa? I had never expected that.
Well, the and I've said this quite a bit. The thing that surprised me the most is how inaccurate. The media is, the news media, particularly cable news. what I experienced, and I've talked about this with my friends quite a bit, is there various hot button issues would come up, and you know, I'm actually in the room for debates, and we've got this pieces of legislation and this kind of thing on our desk, and we're in the room, we've got our staff in there, we're looking at the facts of the bill, or we're in the negotiation, and you know, you hear a radio host or a blogger or somebody on, and you know, one of the things I've learned is that there's a long line of people standing outside each one of those cable news studios who used to work on the Hill, they don't anymore, and they've got some opinions, so they cycle them into there, and they speak like they're speaking like they were in the room, they're speaking like it's fact, but it's really just opinion, they're just guessing, and the folks back home hear this, and they call me, you know, they call up and they say, how could you guys vote? How could you guys vote on a bill that you've never read? And I say, the bills, we've had the bill for 2 months. We've been debating the bill. The bill's in my hand. Oh no. I heard the guy on the radio. He said you just voted on a bill that you didn't even read. But I said, you've known me for 10 years. I'm telling you now I had the bill. Oh no, I believe me, it was on Fox News. And so that's the biggest surprise to me is the willingness to sensationalize inaccurate information and put out opinion as if it were fact, when it has nothing to do with the situation at hand, and it makes the job of the folks that are actually trying to govern infinitely harder, because there's this hurricane of misinformation out there, and folks just don't know who to trust. You know, one of the funniest things that happened in the most recent campaign was that the congressman, we had a series of four debates in about a week's time. Those were the four debates of the campaign, and in almost every one of them, Barry said to the folks, he said, "You listen, you've got to have to stop getting your facts off of Facebook." He said, "Here's the truth about this. Here's the facts. Here's the Congressional Research Service report. Here's the black and white facts about what you're saying is not true, and it's indisputable evidence that what you're saying is false." So he repeated this, and he said in each one of the debates something like, "Stop getting your facts from Facebook." In the final debate, one of the opponents says, when it came to the candidate-to-candidate question, he said, "Okay, Barry, why are you against the First Amendment?" And Barry said, "I'm sorry, I don't have a clue what you're talking about. I don't have a clue what you're talking about." And he said, "Well, in four times this week, you've told us not to believe what we read on Facebook. Why are you against Facebook, and why are you against the First Amendment rights of people on Facebook?" And I mean, the folks in the room, I think, were with me with kind of a jaw drop. He was actually arguing that we should believe what everything we see on Facebook. And I'm not saying everything on Facebook is false. I'm saying folks are out there, and it's very hard to know who to believe and who to trust. There are some reporters and some bloggers and some TV hosts who want to be accurate. One of my favorites, and I'll plug him here, is Jamie Dupree. Jamie's up here. Jamie Dupree may be the last great field reporter who is absolutely as biased as anybody I've ever unbiased as anybody I've ever seen on the planet. He's one of the guys that we can respect and talk to and know that he's going to report fairly and try to just put out the facts. So that's the thing for me that was the most surprising, is how willing a lot of the news media, particularly the high-profile news media, is to just put out opinion and sell it as if it were facts. And it really gets folks worked up, and we get a lot of calls about stuff that they've heard on Fox News or on one of the radio shows or on CNN or MSNBC or one of those channels, and they get worked up. And what we've learned over a year and a half is we really just try to be patient and take the time to talk to folks. And by and large, if we can present them with facts and send them the facts or you know, take the time to have a conversation with them, they'll say, "Well, I appreciate you. I appreciate you setting me straight on that." So if they'll call or if they'll email us, we try our best to do that. But that's been the biggest learning curve for me, the biggest surprise. What was that? What was the second half of your question?
What was the least surprising thing? There's something that you figured it was going to be like that. That's exactly how it was.
Yeah, politics is politics. The politics is the same everywhere. You know, the congressman has a thing. You know, he says a lot. You know, people ask him why did he get into politics, and he said, "Look, I really hate politics." If you think about the word, poly means many, and ticks are blood-sucking parasites. So there's only a small percentage of those guys out there. But that's the thing, is politics is, and it's not just, it really is just not in government. Politics is in human nature. That doesn't surprise me, that the folks, you know, the type of folks that you deal with sometimes in politics, that's the least surprising.
Oh, yeah. Neil and I both work for large corporations. And so politics is something that, you know, especially office politics is a big thing. So imagine it's, but it's also the same, like we talked about before, relationships are important. You know, that if you build relationships with the people you work with, whether it's in Washington, D.C., or at a Fortune 500 company, it's gonna help you in the long run. Let me ask you about this. And this something becomes, you know, and a lot of times it happens with people. They automatically have higher aspirations. And I mean, and the congressman has done that. He's gone from state representative to state senate. Now he's in Congress. Is it a matter of, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and if an opportunity presents itself, then maybe I'll go to something higher, maybe Senate or something like that? Or is it a situation where he's saying, okay, we want to get to this position, or is it just a matter of, I'll take it as it comes, and whatever happens, happens? I know you're kind of asking you to get inside his brain a little bit, but you're pretty close to him, so you can kind of get an understanding of what that's like.
Oh, that's easy. With him, it's, and that's why I'm here, is because he really does. When you see, there are statesmen and stateswomen out there, and we go through cycles that I think in our history where we have a few, and then we have enough. And when in those times when we have more of the statesmen, stateswomen, if that's a word, I think that's when we make some of our greatest progress, because it takes a statesman rather than just a politician to make some of the hard choices that we have to make sometimes, and that we've had to make over the courses of our history. With him, I mean, he really, again, that's why I'm here, is that I saw, it's dig in, and let's, you know, he was sought out by, he's part of a project called the Article One Project, with Senator Mike Lee, and the whole House, since Ryan became Speaker, he's part of his 5-point agenda is this Article One, because he saw what they were doing made a lot of sense. But Mike Lee reached out to Barry, and we've got a very small group. It's 10 people, 2 in the Senate and 8 in the House. And basically the reason he reached out to me is because I'm looking for a group of people who want to solve problems, who are more worried, who are more concerned about solutions than headlines. And that's what he really wants to dig in and find solutions to problems. And the thing about that is, you have to be a statesman to kind of have that mindset, because we tend as a Congress, and this has been since the beginning, you tend to try to attack symptoms, and because symptoms are easy, and it's kind of a defense mechanism. It's like what they do, you know, we do a lot of times with the president or whatever administration it is you're just kind of playing hockey, and they're the puck's sliding at you and you're slapping it back. What we need to do is start to try to find the core, the root of the problem. And those things are not, the problems that we have in our government up here right now are not, they're never going to scroll across the bottom of Fox News. Now, if we start to make some headway with some of the solutions we're doing, that might make the news, because it's going to make some people mad. But the core problems we have and what we're dealing with in this Article One project and other things are real solutions. These are things that would actually fix problems. You know, people think we have the power of the purse. We're constantly getting screamed at that you should be controlling Obama and you should be controlling all these agencies because you have the power of the purse. The real hard truth is, we've ceded the power of the purse away 50 years ago. This thing, we've started relinquishing that power a long time ago, going back to Wilson and FDR and beyond, up through the 70s. They don't really have the power of the purse. As a matter of fact, there's not even one purse. There's 4, 5, 6 purses, and some of these agencies are self-funding. So there's core problems with restoring the Article One power so that Congress can do the things that people expect Congress to do. Those are problems. Those are things that he's working on. And I say all that because that's an example of that's what he's focused on. And so, you know, what usually happens is that folks like that end up being recruited to run for another office because they're effective and they really in it for the right. If you're able to find solutions, if you're able to do the relationship part, if you're able to build alliances and actually get things done, people come and say, hey, you know, I think you do a good job as a senator. And sometimes people overreach and they run for senator and even get it, and they may not be cut out for it. But does he plan for it? No. There is a mind. You know, we did hear of a mindset when we got up here. There were a few people who said, look, when you come to D.C., you got to figure out which track you're going to be on. Do you want to be a committee chairman, or do you want to eventually be a senator, or do you just want to be a rank and file? And this is the track you're going on. And we were kind of dumbfounded by that conversation because it was so they were so frank with the conversation and to say, you know, these are realities and you got to choose which path you're on. Well, we're not going to choose. What we're going to choose is do what he said he was going to do. We're going to build real relationships and start trying to solve some problems because we've got some major problems. But we think we can overcome them. We think we can fix them, fix the problems that we have. But we know we can because we're Americans. We've got some things to do, and that's what we're working on. That's what he's working on. There are folks that choose a track. He's not one of those guys. I mean, if I had to guess, knowing him personally and working for him, I would guess that this is not the end. But I don't know that. I mean, he's very family oriented, and his family seeks God's wisdom and his family's input, and they don't do anything apart from each other, and so they'll decide if that opportunity ever came up.
Very cool, Rob. You know how I can tell that you're a pretty good chief of staff?
I don't.
Because we brought you on to talk about yourself and your job, and you managed to do that while simultaneously, you did that very well, by the way, while simultaneously talking up your congressman quite well, sir.
Yes.
Quite well.
This is our life. We're serious. I mean, I guess it comes off as kind of corny sometimes, but I mean,
no, not at all.
No,
there's some great guys up here. There's some great men and women up here who are, you know, and that's going back to the media, and the thing that surprises me is there are some great men and women who really want to dig in to do the right thing. And sometimes you have to negotiate and you have to give and take. You have to make the sausage, as they say up here. And the problem with our culture right now is if you do one thing that folks don't disagree with, they're ready to fire you and right. hire somebody else. I mean, Barry's analogy is that, you know, we as a culture, as a conservative especially, you know, all we want is the Hail Mary. We want to call the Hail Mary on every down, and after the fourth down, we come off the field, we execute the offense, and send 12 new 11 new guys out there to run the same four plays again. Why can't we win? You know, we got to run and get some first downs. We'll throw a 20-yard pass every once in a while, but it's blocking and tackling. And if you try that, they'll run you out of town.
That is some great insight.
Perfect
Rob.
Analogy.
And we've got to wrap up here in just a minute, but we really do appreciate you coming on to talk to us about that and give our listeners a little glimpse into the world of how the sausage is made, as it were. So
well, I appreciate the opportunity and appreciate what you guys do.
Yeah, no, this was great. It's very insightful, and I a good number of people are going to listen and gain some insight into what goes on there every day. You know, the reality, not what you said, what you see on Fox News or what you hear on talk radio, or even, you know. And I work for Red, I write for Red State, and so there's times when there's some stuff that'll be, you know, be sensationalized a little bit, and sometimes it's just not really like that. So.
I would have never lumped Red State into the group. I mean, that's a good solid. Most of the time, that's a good solid opinion. Passionate, sometimes very passionate, and I don't agree with every word, but I would never have lumped it into that group that I referenced, because it really wouldn't have come to mind. And that's an honest assessment.
Oh, I appreciate
that. I'm gonna look for. I'm going to look for some critique of my performance from my friend Charlie Harper, since I know you guys know him.
And, yeah.
I'm going to, I just threw that out there because we're going to test and make sure he's listening to your show.
Make sure he doesn't say anything. Exactly. Exactly.
If he doesn't say anything to any of us that we mentioned his name, then you'll know.
Exactly. All right, Rob. Well, we got one more piece of business before you go.
We do. And this is something that we do with all our guests. And this is the only real gotcha question that we have on the show. And please don't make this into more than it is. It's a very simple, you know, column A, column B kind of question. But Jay and I, we have this eternal debate. It never ends. We never agree. And so we decided to just turn it over to our guests. And that question, that essential question, which we think speaks to the human condition. Do you prefer Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin?
Ooh.
You had to pick.
Oh my goodness. Watch my political skills. No comment.
No.
Look. I'm gonna go with Sinatra. Because yes. I've been on a Sinatra kick for probably the last 6 months, so I gotta go with. I have to go with Sinatra.
Fair enough. But you just made Jay a very happy constituent.
in my case, actually, Bing Crosby might be a close second before Dean Martin.
Wow, look at that. He's not even putting Dino second there, Neil.
He rejects his false options for a third way.
That's right.
Yep. I'm a big Bing fan myself. He seems to, you know, take it nice and easy.
Pretty smooth.
All right. Well, Rob, we appreciate it again, you being on. This was a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it, guys.
All right. And everyone, we appreciate you listening in. I'm Jay Caruso, and for Neil Dewing. Hey, you know what? Again, just as a reminder, if you like this podcast, go out there, register, tell your friends, leave a review.
Tell your mom.
And we will see you next time here on the Fifth Estate. Have a good night.